Okay, so I continue with physics, and I would like to tell you how you can calculate next to leading order calculations and maybe also next to leading order corrections, not doing it analytically, but doing it numerically via Monte Carlo methods. That's why Monte Carlo appears here in the title. And basically to start, I took here an example from Atlas. You see six jets to calculate next to leading order is not so easy, and that's basically where we aim at. Basically, next to leading order calculations for high multiplicity of partons in the final state. So basically, that's basically what we would like to get. Next to leading order, a lot of partons, particles, and basically fully differentiable for any infrared safe observable. It's well known, we have to calculate two things, which we usually call the real part and the virtual part. Now, let me just mention what one usually does, not me, but other people. So basically, of course, we need the leading order part, that's the bone cross section. For that, we know efficient methods. The real part, the matrix element, is like a bone, just one part or more. The same methods apply there. Unfortunately, the real part is a little bit divergent due to infrared divergences. Usually, one regulates them by the subtraction method. You subtract something and add it back. Then the thing, real emission minus subtraction, is finite. You can integrate it. And then most people will tell you the real bottleneck is the virtual part where you have to do the loop integrals. Most people will do them in such a way that they say we have a few master integrals, boxes, triangles, bubbles, and so on, and the only thing we need to know are the coefficients in front of them. And these boxes, bubbles, and so on, there are only a few of them. You know them analytically. They are calculated once and for all, and basically there the loop integration is in there, and basically you integrate out this loop analytically. Then, in the end, basically, since you would do it fully differential for any infrared safe observable, you'd go to Monte Carlo and say the integration over the phase space you do by Monte Carlo integration. So, with these methods, basically, in the recent years, there has been a tremendous progress, and basically, there are basically two groups. The one group basically uses Feynman diagrams like you learn it in the textbooks, but with very sophisticated methods to be able to go to these processes with high multiplicity. The other groups, and that's basically the mainstream today, uses unitarity or cut-based techniques. I will tell you about a third possibility, and basically let me come back to this subtraction method for the real part. What one does there, it's basically shown again, the real part plus the virtual part, that's what you need. The real part has infrared divergences. You subtract something out, you add it back. What you subtract out is d sigma a. What you add back is exactly the same, you just write it differently. It's I with this multiplication times the bone. That's basically you add it back and do one integration analytically, which is simple. And then you have the virtual part. And with that, basically, here's the pointer, you can assure that basically this thing you can do numerically by Monte Carlo methods on a computer. Now, if you now think about the computational costs once you have done everything, let's say cut-based technique, or even you do the full one-loop calculation analytically, you find basically, as I told you, basically the matrix elements you can calculate efficiently using the recurrence relation. You use Monte Carlo for the phase space integration. You can automate real emission minus subtraction term. Most people don't talk about it anymore. When you add it back, the term you add back is, from CPU time, very cheap. It's almost like a Born term. The virtual correction, once, let's say, you do it really analytically, also get the coefficient of the master integrals analytically, you code it into your program, then it's usually rather fast, and the most time you spend when you really run your program to calculate something is for the real emission minus the subtraction terms. Thereby, you have to invest a lot of CPU time to get a good statistics and a small Monte Carlo error. Depends on the code, but assuming that you basically worked a lot on these virtual corrections. What I would like to tell you, basically, if this really sets the time scale, there's no point in having a super fast code for the virtual corrections. What you only need is basically the virtual corrections should be of the same order as the real emission. Otherwise, you just waste time in optimizing things which don't count in the end. So that's exactly what we are doing. We are basically looking for a method which scales exactly like this real emission part. So our approach is never change a winning team. So in the real emission part, we had divergences. We used the subtraction method to make them integrable. So we thought, well, why don't we do that with the loop part as well? The first part is a trivial observation, that the Monte Carlo integration does not scale with the dimensions you're integrating over. So you do the phase-based integration anyway by Monte Carlo methods. Why not take the integration over the loop momentum for additional integrations in one big Monte Carlo integration and integrate it? The Monte Carlo error will be independent of the number of dimensions you integrate over. Of course, you say, well, that's not trivial because there's a problem. Because you know loop integrals are divergent. You don't calculate them in four dimensions. You usually use dimensional regularization to regulate them. How do you do a Monte Carlo integration 3.99 integrations? That's a little bit tricky. But then you remember, I had this problem already before. In the real part, I also had the problem that I have to integrate something which is basically divergent. And I first subtract out basically the things which give me the divergence and add them back. And when I add them back, I add simple pieces back. So let's try that again. Let's do our loop integration, also write it. We have a subtraction term which makes this thing convergent, so we can integrate it in four dimensions. And then we add basically the subtraction term back and hope that the subtraction term is simple enough that we get a nice result here. So basically, our approach for next to leading order is basically we split what we have to calculate in three pieces. The real part minus some subtraction terms like everybody else. Then we play the same game for the virtual part minus some other subtraction terms. And we have to add both things back. The I is basically from the real part, the L for the loop from the virtual part. When we have these subtraction terms here, these things are convergent, we can go to four dimensions. Same part here, by construction, that thing is convergent, we can go to four dimensions. And then basically, these two things which we add back are simple. We do the analytic integration once and for all, they are just like Lego bricks. And then all explicit poles in our regularization parameter cancel in that part. So basically, we have the subtraction terms. That's the first step we do. Then I will explain you, it's unfortunately not enough. We have to do some contour deformation. I'll tell you later why. And then, once we also did this contour deformation, we can integrate everything by Monte Carlo method. So this idea is not new. Here in the United States, it's basically David Soper who proposed this method already a long time ago. What is new is basically all the technical details which makes this method to work and to work efficiently. So basically, when we started this business, basically our starting point that we found basically a very nice compact formula for the infrared subtraction terms for the loop amplitude which we need. Basically, up before us, basically, people were looking at a graph by graph, deriving it basically with computer algebra system from a graph. Was too slow. Will never work. will not work efficiently. Now, in order to get to this nice formula, I have to remind you that basically a one-loop amplitude you can write as a linear combination of simpler gauge-invariant objects, which we call primitive amplitudes. The important point is primitive amplitudes have a fixed cyclic ordering and are gauge-invariant. That's what we will need. Now, this fixed cyclic ordering has an advantage. Because now think about a generic one-loop amplitude, label the momentum from P1 to Pn. If you have a fixed cyclic ordering, and you say this one-loop momentum has some certain value, then if you also know all external momentum, you know every other loop momentum, and there are only n different loop momenta. Without the cyclic ordering, you would have of the order n squared different values of different loop momenta. So here with the cyclic ordering, there are only n. And then basically we can write basically the loop amplitude for this cyclic ordering, this primitive loop amplitude, basically an integral over the integrand. The integrand is a product of propagators times some polynomial basically in the loop momentum here. So now we need basically a subtraction term for that thing, because this thing might have singularities, infrared, ultraviolet. So let's first start with the infrared subtraction terms. And that's basically in the field I'm working. Usually one talks about very long formulas which you measure in gigabytes or megabytes. The infrared subtraction terms for a primitive one-loop amplitude, independent of how many legs it has, it fits on one line. I really find the formula nice, and yeah, it's a nice formula. So basically, that is what we subtract, and then we integrate it over the loop momentum and add it back. The thing we add back is basically exactly the infrared poles of this one-loop amplitude, and it's a well-known formula. So basically what we found is basically this formula down here was well known, these poles. They have exactly that form. What we found is basically a local form for the integrand, which matches exactly in this loop space at every point the singular behavior of our loop amplitude. And once we found this thing, we basically started to get the thing to work. So that was our starting point. We said, we have this nice formula. It must work. So, yes, that's it. Basically has to fall off in the ultraviolet because that thing subtracts the collinear diversion, and it should not introduce an artificial ultraviolet diversion. So it has to have this behavior. And basically, since it's for the collinear part, basically we fix basically in the collinear limit has to be 1. Otherwise, you can choose different
options. In any color order amplitude, you will have also smaller loops, right? So is this IG? What is IG?
At the moment, we are talking about a one-loop amplitude.
Yeah, no, I understand. But you were showing one loop with n legs.
Okay, let me go back.
You might have smaller loops, right?
If you have smaller loops, you can always write a propagator and the same factor in the numerator, and then you put it just simply here in the polynomial. Okay. So that's basically your top-level diagram, and all smaller loops you obtain by pinching, which basically only modifies this polynomial here. Okay, that was for the infrared part. You also need it for the ultraviolet part. Here's one thing you might know in QCD. It's a conventional wisdom, you have logarithmic divergences from the ultraviolet part. Now, if you start in loop space and run out to infinity in one direction, you easily see that actually you have up to quadratic divergences locally. It's only the average out when you do some angular integrations over a big sphere. That means we have to match. We would like to have the countertems locally. It means we have to match the quadratic, linear, and logarithmic divergences locally. Okay, that's all what is to say about. That's not very difficult to do. It's basically you get them, you think about what happens when the loop shrinks to a point, and you find appropriate counter terms, you can integrate them back. And here in this formula, the only thing which I would like to mention that we add here some term which is actually not ultraviolet divergence. We add some finite part. We're also free to do that. We can always add here a finite part and subtract it here. In choosing here this finite part appropriately, we can always ensure that the integrated form is 1 over epsilon minus a log over some free scale, which we can choose here, and the renormalization scale here. That we do and ensure that it's always like that. Then we know automatically if we sum up all integrated subtraction terms, they will always be proportional to the Born amplitude, because the poles have to be proportional to the Born amplitude, then also the logs here, and nothing else. So that was a nice part. Now comes the nasty part. Basically, contour deformation. What we subtract out is basically everything which, if you do an analytic integration, would give you a pole in 1 over epsilon or 1 over epsilon squared after analytic integration. These are all taken out by our subtraction terms, and these subtraction terms are universal. They're process independent. You only have to think about them once. They're like little Lego blocks. That's very nice. Still remains singularities of the integrand where you can actually escape into the complex plane. I will show you that in the next transparencies. These singularities are not universal, so you don't find universal subtraction terms for that. And we treat them by contour deformation. And of course, if your process you're looking at has some physical singularity, like a threshold where it diverges, of course, that's what you would like to get out, so it's there. So now, what you find in textbooks, basically, if you have a propagator, you have Feynman's I epsilon prescription, which tells you, if you look, for instance, in the time component of the loop momentum, you have to avoid the poles going around like that. And that's basically what you have to do, because if you have basically a non-pinch singularity, you can escape into the complex plane, and you better do so. Otherwise, it becomes totally unstable from your Monte Carlo point of view. So Cauchy's theorem tells you the contour you chose, you can choose whatever you like. You should get the same result as long as you don't cross any poles. That's true. If you do it by Monte Carlo, you better avoid poles as far away as possible, otherwise your integration error will depend on the contour, also the mean result will not. So, and that is basically the real crucial point of this whole method is, what is the best contour to choose, basically, for your Monte Carlo integrations? This picture is a little bit misleading because it's basically in one dimension. I should really tell you that what you should think about is basically you integrate over four variables in a complex space of four complex dimensions, eight real dimensions, and you have basically an integration of a four-dimensional subspace in there. Because there are possibilities where you cannot deform basically in the time component, but where you still have the freedom to deform in the spatial components. So it's I come to it in 5 minutes. So basically, there are two ways to do the contour deformation directly in loop momentum space. There you have to think how your contour winds, and that's the method we recommend. There's a simpler method where you introduce additional finite parameters. Well, it's very simple to define the contour deformation, but it's numerically a little bit unstable. So, if you only have one cone, it's very simple how to deform. You always have to deform when you're sitting on the cone inside the cone. The problem you face, basically, is that you have many cones. So instead of drawing many cones, we just draw, basically, the origin of a cone. And think about here, basically, here sits a cone, which basically gives you some singularities in your integration region. And here you have different cones. So for different particles, you get something like that, which looks a little bit like a Wilson loop. And basically, that's basically what we think about geometrically. And basically, the real challenge for us is that we have basically an integral which is oscillating. So basically, we would like to get something like that, where you have a constant term and an oscillating term. Now, this oscillating term can be big, and we will give you a big Monte Carlo integration error. Once you know that your problem is like that, there's also a simple recipe to overcome it. It's called antithetic variates. You just evaluate the integral at x and 1 minus x, then basically this oscillating term averages out with two integrand evaluations. Now, going back here, let's take basically this origin of cones. We also do something. We split it in different channels, where basically each line segment is a channel. Then we have here this line segment. And now you can ask basically what is a good coordinate system for a line segment, where you have basically a dedicated line segment. The answer is it's an elliptical coordinate system, where your coordinates look like that, and here you see the line segment. So what we do, we use these generalized elliptic coordinates and do antithetic variates in these coordinates, and these are the right ones. So, okay, I told you basically all quantities we can calculate by recurrence relations. That's well known. Let me skip that. And let me come to some results. So what we have, basically, we checked basically E plus E minus going to a bunch of jets in the leading color approximation. And the simplest one is basically two jets. In blue is basically a traditional next to leading order calculations. That's not too complicated. So that gives you the blue line. The red dots are our results from the numerical method. Perfectly works. Next thing, three jet, same thing. Four jet, same thing. Always lies on top of the curve as it should. And then we can just scale it up. We change one line in our program, and we get results for 5, 6, and 7 jets, basically. So it really works basically up to one loop, 8-point functions, the method. And now, no, not yet. Okay. What is also good, basically, is the scaling behavior of our method. How does the CPU time grow with the number of external lags? And this number basically depends on the method we use to calculate tree-like objects. We use recursive relations, and the version we use, case like n to the power 4, Fabio will tell me I can improve it down to n to the power 3. That's true. I could. We didn't do it yet in this version here. And we actually see, basically, that the method, basically, if we fit a curve, we actually fit exactly this exponent, n to the power 4. And that is better than the unitarity method, which scales like n to the power 9. So in leading color, yes. And now, what I did up to now was for massless particles. Now, everything works as well for massive particles. So we can think about basically a one loop integral where you have a mass inside the integral, and then you get thresholds. So here's one example, basically, where you see basically in the real part, basically a discontinuity, and in the imaginary part, a singularity. The blue curve is again the analytic result. Basically, we took, basically kept the external momentum fixed and varied the internal mass here. And basically, we know the analytic answer. It's given by the blue curve. And the red points are, again, from our numerical method. And you really see, basically, we get this jump, very accurate. And we also get, the basically, the singularity, very accurate. If you look a little bit closer, you see is that if we approach the discontinuity from one side, we don't actually have a, basically, our error does not get bigger. But on the other side, it gets a little bit bigger. And we understand that, because basically what we do, we have to find a contour, and our contour is defined by cones. So what happens? Basically, you have two cones or hyperboloids in the massive case. If they're far away and approach each other, nothing happens. That's from one side. And then they cross each other, and there's some internal region opens up, and that basically gives some contribution, but it's first small, and the algorithm has to find it, which makes this error a little bit larger. But the main message is it works also very well for thresholds and things like that. A few words, basically, how to generalize it to higher orders. So basically, this contour deformation, basically, I would just like to... Two loops, three loops, and there's just, it's a one loop, but I would like to make the point. This kappa is our deformation vector. It tells you how we deform into the complex space. This kappa for a one loop amplitude has to vanish whenever one of the loop momenta basically is soft. You have no choice there. Kappa has to be zero whenever basically one of these momenta is soft. So you have no deformation there. Now it's two loops. So what we would like to do is basically say, okay, we solved the one loop problem and bring the two loop problem down to iterative structure of a one loop problem. The first thing we think about basically is a two loop problem is basically two loops. Right? Mathematicians always get confused. They say, well, if you draw that diagram, it's three cycles. And that's important. Because imagine that, basically, momentum becomes soft. If you say you have one independent loop here, one independent loop here, you're forced that both deformations vectors are zero. But you still, and that does not work. You will bluntly run into a divergence because you forgot the big circle here and you have a freedom to deform here. So basically, if we would like to apply that thing basically recursively to higher loop diagrams, it's not the number of loops which counts, it's the number of inequivalent cycles, and you have to do it for every cycle. Otherwise, it's straightforward. Okay, so let me skip that. And basically, for two loops, basically, you can always bring it down basically to this topology. That's the most general topology for two loops, and for three loops, it's that thing. So you basically say, okay, I have two independent loop momenta. I need a deformation for both. And I get them that I look at all possible cycles where this loop momentum appears in. So there's one cycle. Let's take this loop momentum K1 here. It's a big cycle, C1 and C2, and it's a small upper thing here, C1, C3. And you apply basically the one loop method here and here. That's basically the way it works. That one I skip. And basically with these methods, basically we were able to reproduce basically some non-trivial analytical results for two and three loops, propagator corrections, vertex corrections, double box, triple box, gave the right numbers. We also were able, basically, to get results where no analytical results are known. And there, basically, our main intention was to see if we get it stable. For instance, two-loop six-point functions, we have no problems. So, and that basically brings me to the conclusions. What I told you, basically, is basically for next to leading order calculations, a third method apart from Feynman diagrams or unitarity techniques to calculate really in the multi-parton range if you have a lot of partons. This method is basically very fast for if you have to calculate the integrand. So I believe it's basically, if you really go to a high number of partons, it's probably one of the best methods. We have basically first result for electron-positron annihilation. We're currently working on the cross process. Basically, we have set production plus a bunch of jets. And we are also very much looking forward to see if we can get this method to work, not only at next to leading order, but also to next to leading order. Thank you.
First a comment and then a question. The comment is that there are well-known example of complete electro recalculation at the two-loop level done numerically on the market.
Yes.
For instance.
Yeah.
The question is, can you handle complex masses and or complex momenta?
Yes, that is not a problem. We actually need it already in the two-loop case. I mean, let's go here. If you have a deformation here in this vector, basically the external momenta basically of the other loop become complex. Yeah, we need it. We can handle complex momenta, yes, it's not a problem. Complex masses, yes, we can handle them as well. We actually use this trick. Let me go back to the ultraviolet part here. Here we introduce a mass basically in the denominator, and we can choose whatever we like here. So we don't want this propagator, it's an artificial propagator, to mess up with the propagators of our problem. So what we actually do, what turns out to be convenient, to choose this mass purely imaginary. There's nothing which forbids us, and we actually do it, and it's a good thing to do.
Okay, but the question was more, how do you go to the second Riemann sheet for the complex masses, which, you know, there is where you have to go.
It's basically our method, basically, never makes a jump. I mean, we start somewhere to integrate, and then it winds itself the right way. So we are not talking about Riemann sheets. We are just talking about finding a contour deformation which is everywhere continuous.
I'm talking about the fact that the complex mass is defined on the second Riemann sheet, not on the first.
What is the problem?
I don't know. I mean, how do you go to the second Riemann sheet in your numerical approach?
We never take square roots.
I think you can fix this over lunch.
Okay. First of all, I'm quite impressed by the advances that you found here in the numerical approach. Now, my question is, can you also use this for threshold dynamics problems when you have Coulomb singularities?
Well, our approach is best suited basically where all the scales of the problem are of the same order. Because then you know that numerically you don't have big logarithm in your final result. For that, this numerical approach is well suited. If you apply this approach to a thing where you have to produce numerically a large logarithm, you run into numerical problems. So that might, it depends, one has to see what you would like to calculate, but I would assume that in the Coulomb things, you might get some logarithms which are you would like to calculate. Same thing also with masses. If, for instance, you would like to apply this approach where you put some electron mass and some W mass, and you have a ratio of an electron mass to the W mass, it's not the best approach here because you have to produce this logarithm numerically. So that is not the main application of that thing. The application is where you basically have a problem where you can say all the scales are within a factor of 10 the same. That's what the target is.
So I wanted to ask you, what's the price that you pay if you go to sub-leading color, for instance, in the plus minus two jets?
Okay,
in terms of the scaling, for instance, that you showed.
Okay, what we are going to do is avoiding to pay a price for subleading color, but also doing some Monte Carlo over colors. We're currently working on that. It's not basically that you say, okay, a quark has three colors and then I dice one. We would like to, that's not the efficient way to do that. But basically, we would like to sample in some way also the color space. That basically then it's at constant cost. Otherwise, of course, I mean, if you do it differently, sum up over all colors, it's the same as your approach. You reintroduce basically a factorial dependence, which we don't want to have.
Yeah, I mean, the subleading color, unfortunately, count not very much, but they're very expensive, right?
If you sum over it, basically, you get basically, again, your factorial, which you don't really want to have because it spoils all of that part.
Yes.
Just to understand, so in your leading color calculation, then, when you talk about primitives, you look at when you talk about the primitive amplitude, you look at only one ordering for your external gluons, say, and then you use the fact that the phase space is symmetric when you do this?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. And basically, we plan to do something similar for the subleading color.
In the two and three loop examples which you have shown, are you sort of proceeding exactly along the same way as in the one loop so that you introduce subtraction terms that can be integrated analytically, or what you have shown there is basically a successful application of the contour deformation onto the whole integral?
It's basically what I've shown up to now is basically the integrals we calculated were infrared and ultraviolet finite. Mm-hmm. So these are basically finite two and three loop integrals. And basically
of the all legs off shell, all external legs off shell.
Exactly.
Okay.
So basically no internal mass, but all external legs off shell, high enough propagators that they're also ultraviolet finite. Yep. The reason for looking at that part first was the following. Our biggest problem in the one loop case was not the subtraction terms. There we were lucky and this very nice formula. We spent almost 1.5 years in figuring out the efficient contour deformation. That was really painful, I can tell you. And basically, so we thought, okay, if that was the most complicated part, we first check if it works also at two loops and three loops. And there, we are now lucky to see, okay, the work we invested at one loop, there we invested something, but we can profit from it. We still need the subtraction terms at two loop to subtract the infrared part. So ultraviolet is more or less straightforward, but the infrared, but I don't think they're too complicated.
Well, I would be very curious to see them. I think a lot can be learned from these structures once you have established them, from the infrared structure.
Yeah, but I think you'll sit down and guess them. It's
okay. All right, thanks.
Yes. So do you see any obstacle to go to other collisions? Like, so initial state divergences are only for the real normal counter term for those?
No, as I told you, we are basically currently looking in Z plus jet production.
Okay. Okay, so we thank Stefan again. Now we have Bernd that will tell us a bit about a story, right? And the story is about how we describe now and how we can understand plutonium production, which is something that's been going on for a long time now.